This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 32 of What's It Like. My guest is Andrew Main. He's an illusionist and a magician. And what else?
Writer, I guess.
Yeah, and TV producer and lots of books and stuff.
Can't hold a job. Yeah, basically.
I heard a rumor that Penn and Teller were struggling and they were always interrupting each other. And you were the one that told Teller to shut up. Is that true?
I worked for a little while for them a while ago. And, you know, it is funny that Teller, although his persona on stage is silent, in personal life and when you meet him, he is a quite talkative person and very interesting. He's a very deep, very, very smart, very profound guy and very interesting to talk to.
Now, you didn't start off as a magician. At least you didn't start off with the name Andrew Main. When did that come into being?
Well, Main was my middle name. It was a family name. And that was just I had used, you know, you go through when you're a teenager, you know, you call yourself all sorts of different names. And, you know, despite the rumors, my family was not so embarrassed that they demanded I use another name. Although my brother would tell you that. I'd used Andrew Main for a little while. Then I had a buddy whose father was an entertainer. And this was in high school. So his father was an entertainer. His father's name was the Cisco Kid. Okay. So he was a guy that played the guitar. He also did John Lennon impersonations. And so he was a fixture in the South Florida entertainment scene. And so, you know, I'd come hang out with my friend and, you know, Cisco would say, hey, you know, we do magic. Oh, that's cool. And so he wanted to help me out. So he would start introducing me to everybody as Andrew Main. And so pretty soon I became, you know, Andrew Main to, you know, the entertainment community in South Florida. And like, I wasn't like, all right, okay. I was 15. Sure. Fair enough. And then it just sort of stuck with me. And, you know, my dad was in law enforcement. My brother's in law enforcement. So it probably helps having a different name considering, you know, they go after bad guys.
What was it like growing up in Florida?
You know, I lived in Oregon until I was about 12. Then we moved to South Florida. And the nice thing about South Florida is if you're into boats and water and fishing, you've got all that there. None of that appealed to me. So that's why I got into entertainment and magic and filmmaking.
What was it? Do you remember the first trick that you did?
First trick I ever learned was something my grandfather taught me. And it was a very simple card trick where somebody selects a card and then you tell them the card they were thinking of, and a very basic principle, but it was one of those things that stuck with me for a long time because of this realization that adults could be fooled. Mm. And that's probably where I, you know, the young skeptic was born, was, yes, realizing, wow, people who are intelligent can be fooled, and being smart doesn't mean that you're invulnerable to that.
Mm-hmm.
That was and since, you know, I've had my life has sort of been split along magic, the technique and psychology of it, and then education and outreach for that. I did a program that was underwritten by Johnny Carson where he paid for me to go into schools and to teach kids about magic and critical thinking. And I drew a lot of my experiences based upon, you know, what was it like when I first encountered magic and how was I fooled and how are we fooled by other things?
Mm-hmm. So you grew up in Oregon and then moved to Florida. Was that a big shift for you?
Oh, very much a big shift. You know, the Pacific Northwest, I lived in a little town outside of Oregon outside of Portland called Gladstone. And lived on the edge of a forest, and then you very, very kind of a Midwestern, although it's Pacific Northwest, kind of demeanor about people, and then moving to South Florida, much more diverse, and that was a great experience. It was absolutely a great experience. It was just, you know, going into a very multicultural environment, and you just sort of get a big idea of how much bigger the world is, and great experience. So I think, you know, I'm sure, you know, you talk to a lot of people. I have friends who've sort of lived in one particular place all their life, and you know, they kind of forget there's a big world out there. So
what was your major challenge in school?
You know, my biggest problem was, as a student, was there were things that I liked and there were things I didn't have an interest in. And things that I liked would come easy to me. And then maybe I might get bored of them a little bit. And things that I had no interest in, I didn't want to study, I didn't want to do. And much to, you know, even if you think you're a smart young kid or smart person, it's hard to know what's going to be important later on. And so I didn't realize how much of a future I was going to have involving writing. And so I was a horrible student in English. I would get into like the gifted programs or honors programs, but I was just an absolutely horrible student there because I just didn't understand the basic reasons that you learn these skills in order to become better communicators. And that was my problem. So I was like, my report card was all over the place. It would be A's and D's. You know, it was just this mixture, and it was always hard for my teachers to figure out what was my problem. And it was, I always had better ideas to what to do with my time than I thought they did. And sometimes I was right. My senior year of high school, I mean, I knew I either wanted to be a scientist or a magician. And I realized that being a scientist meant a lot more years of school. Being a magician meant, you know, owning a sequin jacket and hanging out with, you know, really pretty girls with low self-esteem issues. So that was easy for me to solve that problem. So my senior year of high school, my friends were putting together resumes, applications for colleges. I went and I made a demo video, got my girlfriend, went to a magic shop I worked in. We had a stage that looked like this sort of glittery Vegas-y kind of stage. We made a video, and as a joke, and then we made a magic video. But we made the magic video of me performing what looked like I was on a cruise ship. And that was always my kind of thing, that if you want to get to someplace, look like you're already there. Instead of looking like somebody who's trying to get a hand up, look like you're there. So I was 18 years old. I had this tape that looked like I was already working on cruise ships. I sent that out there. And so right out of high school, I started working for, at that point, I had a headlining show on Norwegian Cruise Lines, started doing circuses and other stuff. And it was way over my head, absolutely over my head. But, you know, my friends are like, where are you going? I'm like, oh, I just got booked 6 months straight, you know, to go do this, you know, to live on a boat, perform one day a week and spend the rest of it, you know, sitting in a deck chair on, you know, the Caribbean.
Wow. That's the power of an illusion.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's, I believe a lot in the idea of sort of lifestyle design, you know, sitting down and planning out what do you, and not in a ridiculous, well, I want to be a billionaire and have a Learjet. I mean, if you can figure out how to do that, but more, how do you want to spend your time? Do you want to spend your time 75% of it doing creative stuff and 25% doing the stuff to make that happen? And that was sort of for me that I had, you know, probably when I was about 25 or 26 was the realization that I'd been designing my life without realizing it.
How did your parents impact your worldview?
I am so fortunate to have very supportive parents. My father was a law enforcement agent for a number of years. He was basically like a super cop, highly decorated ATF agent, went after, you know, like large international criminal organizations, you know, worked and collaborated with other, you know, police forces around the world, and had a very, very good reputation as that, was very good at his work, was a very ethical guy too. He was a very compassionate guy. And I could remember my father telling me stories about suspects and people like that. And not like, I mean, you know, these people, some very, very bad people, but my father would sort of understand why they were who they were and kind of helped him get rapport and to deal with people who are on that side of it. But he knew that was his role, that was his life, but he didn't want to press that upon my brother and myself. And so he always encouraged us to find our own path. And so when I liked magic, my father was very supportive of that. When I wanted to do big illusions, the problem when you want to do a big illusion, when you see a magician saw a woman in half or something, that box, that trick, somebody had to make that. Mm-hmm. And that's like a $5,000 thing. And so some people, you know, maybe they have a family and they have money and they just buy it. You know, my family, you know, my parents work for the government. You know, my father would help me build stuff. So Saturday afternoons, we would go build things. So I learned early on, if you want something, you don't have it, make it. Figure out how to get it, but don't just, you know, solve the problem. And so that was a skill my father taught me how to work with my hands, taught me how to, you know, do that. And that just played out into the rest of my life. I'm a very much hands-on kind of person. If I want to do something, I'll learn how to do it, whether it be tools, computer software, whatever. And I'm very thankful for that. You know, my father, you know, just encouraged my brother and I to, you know, be ourselves, but to do stuff, not talk about it. When I wanted to be a magician, he's like, all right, then go be a magician. Don't be a guy that sits around living at our house telling us, oh, I'm going to do this one day. Go do it. And my brother, you know, my brother followed in his footsteps pretty closely. My brother became an FBI agent, and, you know, not because my father said, this is what you do, but my brother looked up to my dad and what my dad did and said, let me follow that path. And, you know, as I got older, I realized my dad had his own little path with entertainment. He used to, used to be a diving board clown in college for money, where he would like do these diving board stunts. I found an old photo of him dressed up like a clown next to a donkey, which I'm like, and I'm like, what's the explanation? It's like, well, I would take the donkey on top of the diving board and then we'd dive into the pool, you know? And this is, you know, my dad's like, you know, super cop. I'm like, all right. So, you know, he had that side too, so he could appreciate that. So I lucked out. I know some people who just, they don't get the support from their family. They get that kind of pressure and an anxiety about what they do. And it really, and understandably so, it can be a scary thing when somebody says, I want to do something like be in entertainment or, you know, heaven forbid, become a psychologist.
Now that you've survived childhood, what constitutes family for you?
Family for me, you know, it's the thing is, like, I knew since I was 15, I wouldn't get married until I was 40. And, you know, that's a weird thing to hear a 15-year-old say, but I always had this very, very strong sense of responsibility. You know, my parents always made sure my brother and I came first. They always looked out for us. And I had friends who had parents who were in entertainment who did not provide perhaps the best environment they could have. And what I mean by that is that, you know, the parents would sometimes make these selfish sort of choices that would affect their kids. And, you know, I think as a parent, you have a responsibility. Your kids got to, not to the point of spoiling your kids, but your kids don't need to worry about that. Are they going to have new shoes when the school year starts? They don't need to worry about, you know, are they, not only are they not going to, you know, is there going to be money for college, but is there going, are they going to be having to support mom and dad when they're 22 years old to help them make their mortgage payments and stuff, which things like that happen. But as a parent or as a potential parent, you know, you want to sort of design your future around that. So I always planned, the idea was I was going to spend, you know, my 20s and 30s doing crazy, stupid stuff that if it failed, I wasn't going to have anybody else have to pay a penalty for that. Nobody was going to have to suffer. And that's, you know, and that's certainly been a, you know, I've been open to the idea if I met the right girl and whatever, and she wanted to get, like, not to rule out like, oh, that. And I've met a lot of fantastic girls that, you know, that the pattern is after I date a girl, you know, for about 6 months, a year or whatever, and if it ends, they end up marrying right after me. So I know something's off with my timing. But, you know, at some point, yeah, I'd love to have kids, love to have that, but I'm still kind of living the Peter Pan lifestyle right now.
Does your profession make it difficult to form relationships?
I think my personality does. I have friends who are in similar professions, who are similar. You know, I know other magicians who have very, very healthy, successful relationships. And, you know, my thing is, like, I'm a very project-focused person. If I decide I wanted to do something, I'm going to go do that 100%. And to the exclusion of not having a social life and not engaging with other people. Because it's a thing that I certainly enjoy to an extent. And, you know, the relationship I have, the girls I get along with kind of understand that, sort of. But, you know, it is different. But I know other magicians that, you know, I have a buddy of mine who's does family type entertainment shows. You know, he'll go work a picnic. He'll do a corporate party. He just flew back from doing a show in Washington, D.C. And he's got a kid. He's got a woman. He's got, you know, he's successful. He is a super father. And, you know, he balances that really, really well. He's very, very good at balancing things. So there are people I think can do that really successfully.
Do you travel a lot as a magician?
I used to travel a lot as a performer, where I would spend, you know, 6 months out of the year on a cruise ship or at a resort. And at this point, I do a lot of lecturing. So I'll go to magic clubs around the country, and I'll go do 5 or 6 of those maybe in a week. So maybe every month or every other month, I'll spend a week on the road doing that. And that's kind of fun. It's a fun way to do that. And also, it's a neat way, because through other things I've done, like the Weird Things podcast and some other stuff that's non-magic, it's also a chance to meet people that have, you know, keyed into some of the other things I do.
How does your writing fit in with the rest of your life?
I've always written, and, you know, I did a lot of nonfiction stuff. I used to write for as magic books. I've written a number of magic books, but those are sort of, I never really thought of that as just writing per se, because a lot of it's just, you know, very descriptive and not, you know, not very verbose. And I wrote for, I did some stuff for Skeptic Magazine. I did some stuff for some of the skeptical literature. And then I kind of never really kind of found where I wanted to get into the writing, but I knew that I wanted to get into fiction. And that was a thing that I knew it wasn't a strength. And that was a thing that I tended to avoid. And then I started taking classes and stuff and trying to find out where, you know, to understand how to analyze what I was doing and understand how do other people look at this stuff, and then kind of sat on it for a while. And then lately I just got into fiction writing, you know, with, you know, the sort of the ebook revolution, because it changed the paradigm. You know, my principal business is I make my money from DVDs and magic books that I sell. I have a library of over 50 books and DVDs that I've created over the last, you know, decade. So that is the main source of income through my website, through wholesale. You go into a magic shop, you'll probably find one of my books or some of my stuff. And that model worked great for me because I could do everything. I could create, I could produce it, I could, you know, edit it, or I could, you know, a video, I could do the covers, I could do all that. I could go around to a, you know, to a wholesaler or a distributor and sell them 1,000 copies and have a market and understand how that works. The idea of getting into fiction writing was different. And I had friends, family friends who had, you know, we knew a guy growing up, a friend of my dad's who would actually wrote like a book a month, was one of these kind of these Western novel type writers. And it was a rough living. And I said, you know, I don't want to get into that point where I send stuff to a publisher and wait a year for it to come back. And, you know, the last year with the way ebooks have changed, it's a totally different paradigm. And that's what, you know, I said, you know what, let me get into this now because I've got stories I've been wanting to tell and let me try that. And I have an audience. So it's been very, very, you know, very positive experience so far.
Because you have an audience in another area, is it easier for you to sell your books online?
Yeah, absolutely. It certainly helps that when you know who the first 50 or 100 people who are going to read this, who they're going to be. And that is very, very helpful. And it's a good way to you to do something and have it and put it out there into a vacuum and just have it sit there. And even if it's the greatest thing in the world, it can be a frustrating experience. And as much as we tell ourselves, oh, I just want to make sure I do something good, you know, there needs to be an audience. It could be a small audience, but you want to have an audience for it. And mm-hmm. So having found, you know, one, having extended outside of magic the last couple of years with the Weird Things website, the Weird Things podcast that I do with Justin Robert Young and Brian Brushwood, which, you know, brought me kind of a new audience of people who love the crazy and the weird stuff, but are kind of sciencey kind of people, you know, told me like, all right, there's other people out there like me and I could write to them.
What's the best thing about your job?
Best thing about my job is I have creative freedom. You know, I get to my day or my week or my month is dictated by following my own projects. And I get to, you know, the frustrating part is, you know, it's a small operation. I have Justin Robert Young works with me. I've got a warehouse and an office where we run sort of the business side of it. And there's a lot of responsibility there. But the best part of it is just the idea that, you know, I got a new trick coming out that involves like what looks like a Polaroid photograph. And so, you know, we've got a couple of weeks, we've been time and energy put into that. And sometimes it's like, man, I'd rather be doing something else. But it's like, well, all that time, it's going to be something that's going to end up in somebody's hands. And all that work that I go into, it's a part of me. It's a part of my imagination and it's something made real. And that keeps me excited about it. And if I create a magic trick and it gets done around the world, you know, or if I see it on television or one of my favorite magicians decides to perform it and other people look at it and go, oh, that's really cool. That's exciting. It's a very gratifying thing. And so for me, that's the beautiful thing is to be creative and to have that creativity have traction.
If I wanted to create a magic trick, where would I start?
I really can't use the competition, so I would prefer to not. I start with, there are two ways that it comes about. One is you can find a scientific principle that's interesting and say, how could I apply this? Or, and I think perhaps for me, my favorite approach is I see something in a movie or a comic book, or I think of something impossible, and then I think, how would I do this? And I like to work, you know, I like to work that way. Like, and so if you have, let's say you say, wouldn't it be weird if this happened? You know, if you said, if you're sitting there and you had a, you know, a cup of coffee and you said, you know, what if the coffee turned back into beans? I'm making this up right now. What if I could just make that whole coffee turn back into coffee beans? And then you'd say, okay, how would I convince the person sitting across from me at a coffee shop that that just happened? Would I pick up the lid, let them smell it, put the lid back in it, shake it, and then open it up and have beans? And then I'd have to pour the beans out. And like, okay, that would be an effective way to do that. So then, I mean, that would be the ideal way for that trick to happen. So then you set about thinking about methods. What are they going to assume that I can then take advantage of? And that trick, you know, the idea is the assumption is when they look into a cup of coffee and they see the top of that surface of the coffee, they assume that it goes all the way down to the bottom of the cup. But maybe it's only an inch worth of coffee there. So things like that. So you start with what would be the best presentation and then I try to figure out methods.
It seems like magic has two major styles. One is equipment-based, like large stage things, you know, cut the woman in half, mm-hmm. and skill-based ones, and a lot of close-up magic focuses on that. Mm-hmm. Are they distinctly different from each other?
I think that it's often hard as an audience member to know when you're seeing skill and when you're seeing apparatus. And ideally, skill and apparatus should vanish in a certain situation. And there is there are magicians that, you know, you can be a stage illusionist and you can buy a bunch of props and hire dancers and have them do it and you just stand in point. And but if you're going to be entertaining in it, you've got to have a really compelling personality. And that's a thing that close-up guys, I know close-up guys like, oh, stage, it's easy. You just do this. And I know close-up guys who are fantastic mechanically. They have great skills. They're horrible entertainers.
Yes.
You know, they have an audience of magicians who, in their show, starts at the fingertips and it ends at the wrists. And that's the same. That's the parallel to guys, stage performers who just buy a box or have a box trick that was some sort of trick apparatus and just point at it and do it. You want to be a compelling personality. If you're a compelling personality, then you just say, okay, how do I do this? You know, David Copperfield is a very skilled magician. David Copperfield's, you know, if you watch, you can see what he looked like as a performer when he was 20 years old. He had his first television special when he was 20. And you watch his sleight of hand when he's doing card productions and all that. There has not been an American performer on television since then that I think was as good as David Copperfield was at he was 20. Hmm. And we tend to sort of, I like the close-up guys or whatever, but go back and look at him there. And he wanted to make his magic scale, and to scale and tend to sort of go towards illusions and bigger stuff, which means apparatus. And there's a weird thing that happens, though. If you have, let's say you saw a woman in half. You put her in a box, then you cut her in half. All right, cool trick. If you get rid of the box, sometimes it can look pretty cool. Sometimes it doesn't. It just comes across as maybe it's a special effect, and then people don't pay attention to it, or it goes into a different part of the brain. And I'm always fascinated by that, in that, because I go, well, technically this should be amazing, but they're like, yeah, but something felt false, or you know, maybe I was looking at a hologram, or they just sort of leap to some sort of weird conclusion. So, you know, I guess the end of it, I guess it answers your question, is I think that a good performer uses both, and you know, if an audience is too aware of one or the other, then I think that it pushes it into it. I can only speak for myself, though, then in a direction maybe I don't want to go into. Mm-hmm.
But the major point is that magicians have to remember that they are entertainers.
Oh, for sure. That was, you know, the father of modern magic was a French magician by the name of Jean-Robert Houdin. And he made the statement that a magician is an actor playing the part of somebody who can do magic. Now, magicians love to tell you this. They love to tell you this, but they really miss the point of it, because then they want to talk to you about the skill and the technique that goes into what they do. Where, you know, when, you know, Jean-Robert Houdin was talking about, like, what he means is, you know, Michael Gambon, the guy who plays, you know, Dumbledore, you know, that's what you need to be, is you need to be an actor. And like your character, your persona on stage. And it doesn't mean you have to really believe that it's real or whatever, but you know, there is a point to the idea of understanding that, you know, even if there is skill or technique on your part, diminish it. I know there are a lot of prominent magicians. As soon as they get the opportunity to talk to, you know, a magazine profile about how skillful they are and how technique, they love to do it, because they're not finding enough value as performers, as entertainers, as you pointed out.
Mm-hmm. What has surprised you about your job?
You know, the thing that surprised me is, you know, I never had a clear goal. I never had a clear goal at what I wanted. And, you know, like a lot of magicians, when I was a teenager, I looked like, oh, David Copperfield, I want to be like him. And then I worked for him and I saw how hard he worked. And I'm like, like, you know what? He can have his success because he earned that. And, you know, the thing that surprises me, and the thing that I'm always learning new stuff. And, you know, the latest revelation that I've had is, and it's a silly, trivial kind of thing, but how much the sense of wonder, you know, how much wonder is an important aspect to it, and how much as a performer, you know, your appreciation of wonder affects the audience's appreciation of it. And what I mean by that is, there are magicians who know really cool, skillful stuff, and they'll go do it, and the audience will be like, okay. But a magician who can remember what it's like the first time you see this card trick and how amazed you are, can remember that the thousandth time they do that, they can be a much stronger performer. And so that's what surprised me, is that I realized how cynical I became, how jaded I would become in my performing style, because like, well, I know it does. And I just, you make that, you know, I'm a big believer of theory of mind, you know, in the classical psychological sense. And I think theory of mind, TOM, is a very, very important thing to realize. I think a lot of magicians have people in general have a very poor understanding of knowing what goes on in other people's minds.
Yes.
And that's what sort of surprised me the most, was how little I really appreciated that.
It's a lot like singers who push a mental button and let the song go and it becomes automatic.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the great ones, you know, you go see, like, and like one of my favorites is still Bono, U2, you know, and, mm-hmm. and, you know, Bono is a guy that loves to run around the stage, hop up on the speakers and go do that. And when you see a performer who says, okay, I'm going to go sing this song, and then just goes and sings the song, and it's like, well, okay, you know, it didn't feel like the first time you sang it.
New every time.
Yeah.
Well, more with Andrew Main right after I remind you of the importance of health. Let me take a moment to introduce you to a disorder that impacts a lot of people. In the UK, it's called ME, myalgic encephalopathy. In the US, it's called CFIDS, chronic fatigue and immune dysfunction syndrome. Whatever you call it, it's a chronic neurological disease of unknown cause and no known cure. Most every body system is impacted, including the musculovascular, immune, and central nervous systems. Symptoms include problems with vision, balance, coordination, pain, and sensitivity to cold, sound, and visceral stimulation. It screws up mitochondrial production and cellular metabolism and replication. For many, it's a totally disabling condition, and even for those patients who get better, it's a relapsing, remitting disease. Although it can occur at any age, it's mostly found in women in their 20s and 30s. My daughter has been sick with this condition since her junior year in college. This is a disorder that really needs more research. So go to cfids.org and donate. CFIDS.org. Thanks. So, Andrew, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
I think that for me, it's been important to realize why I do something. And, when people become creative, when they decide to choose a creative pursuit, it becomes very easy to forget, to lose our way. And you say, did I make as much money as I could have doing this? Did I succeed in this way that I wanted to? Am I getting the sort of attention that I wanted to? And you got to remember that when you're 8 years old or 9 years old and these formative experiences affect who you are and you become a creative personality that's going to want to do creative things later on, certainly the need for attention is part of it. But the real reason that many people, myself, do this is there is this fire, this urge to express and to communicate and to do that. And I think that, I've realized that, when I lost track or I wasn't motivated, it was because I forgot what I was trying to do. And I'm trying to create and communicate. And it's either because I'm creating and not communicating, or I'm communicating and I forgot what I was trying to say. And so for me, it comes back down to what am I? Who am I? What am I? I'm a creator. I'm a guy who likes to be creative. I like to have as many outlets as I can. And I motivate myself by thinking about, how fun will it be to tell the story and have it told successfully and have somebody else experience it like I intended.
When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
I worry at night. I'm a night worrier. So I'm one of these people that during the day, I'm high functioning. When I go to sleep at night, if I'm worried about stuff, and I have a policy, anything I can take care of, I go do. And I don't sort of sit on stuff. And so I don't worry about things I cannot control. I'm very much a believer in that. And so I'm pretty stress-free in that sense. Things that are beyond my control, I don't worry about. Things that I have to deal with, I make sure that I deal with. And I realize that I didn't know this until probably, I wish I'd realized this much when I was much younger, but about understanding why a creative person deviates or doesn't deliver or stops or moves on to other things. And I think the reason is a lot of creative people tend to be intelligent people, is we're used to certain things coming easy. We sit down with a pen and paper and we write out an idea or, a storyline or come up with a trick or a photograph or something we want to do. And then you get to that stumbling block and you get to that point where you're like, I don't know if I can solve this problem, or this problem's a little more hard for me to do it. But sometimes I never even acknowledge that. And then I would hesitate and postpone and it wouldn't get done. And I realized that, if I wrote it down in a sequence of events, I stopped at number four. Why did I stop at number four? And I'm like, oh, because I couldn't make a decision about this. And then I just, try to solve it the easiest way I can and move forward.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
An event that challenged me to the core? I would say, there's been a couple things that have been very formative experiences in who I am. And one of them was the first time I did a big stage show and did big illusions. I did this illusion where I'm locked inside of a box. It was held over a bed of swords. Five guys pulled it up by ropes and I had a couple minutes to get out. And the way the trick worked is I teleported somehow and I'm in the back of the audience watching the audience watch that box. And I realized that, wow, that was a powerful experience to realize that, there was 600 people there watching this, waiting to see if it was going to fall. And then it fell and hearing people scream. And that told me, wow, I can do these things. I was 16, 17 years old. And that was a very, very powerful lesson to learn to pull that off. So that certainly formed me as an entertainer and letting me know that I could do that. On the other side of it, I spent a number of years working in critical thinking, involved in skepticism. And there were instances where we would have people would call. I work for the James Randi Educational Foundation. We'd have people call who had questions about the paranormal or things like that, or their mother went to go see a psychic or somebody like this. And there were a couple instances where I talked to people who were just being lied to and manipulated and having their faith used as an opportunity to get money from them or whatever, and sometimes give people bad advice where people died from that. And that had a profound effect on me that you know, the same skills that I have, other people have, and they use them for evil, and not enough of us are calling people out on being evil for doing those things. And that was, you know, it was kind of all theoretical until, you know, you talk to somebody who's just all choked up about, you know, a family member that died of a disease that they could have been treatable, or maybe wasn't even treatable, but in the last, you know, stages of their life, you know, they were being misled by somebody who was just a fundamentally evil person that was either selling them fake medicines or selling them, you know, treatments that we know that didn't work, or remedies, or just pure voodoo that the purpose of which was just, you know, to profit from them.
The mentalism approach has been around for centuries, and yet doesn't seem to go away. All the logic that we try to teach people and all the critical thinking skills, there's still people who find it difficult to step through a process of evaluating a situation they're in.
Well, we all do, though. And I spent a lot of time in the skeptic community, and the disillusion for me there came from interacting with people that were very, very good at applying the tools of critical thinking to things they chose, whether it be the paranormal or belief, but very, very poor at applying it to anything else that fell outside of what their ideology was. And that was a, you know, I'm a person that's constantly questioning myself and why do I think this and stuff. And I get into arguments with people I might agree with on a ideological point, but I disagree with their basis for it, which is a weird thing to say. But I because I am very, very much about objectivity in the sense it's an approach. It's not something you can declare yourself. And I think that the healthy thing is I've watched in the last several years that if you had questions about stuff, like, I mean, I love the idea of ghosts and all this stuff. I've always found them fascinating. I don't think there's a rational reason to think that they're real, but I don't think there's anything wrong with asking or wanting to know. The beautiful thing is that now if you're 15 years old, you can find everything online. You can find a bunch of bunk, but you can find a lot of people willing to give you an answer if you want it. And that choice, we never had that before. When I was a kid and I was interested in UFOs, I would go into my library and I can almost remember, the Dewey Decimal Code there. I'd find all these bunk books on UFOs and, you know, I wanted to know, but there was no opportunity for me to go online and find anything else. And the problem is that sometimes people focus on, well, there's all this misinformation. I'm like, yeah, but there's good information. And if you believe that people, if they want to find out, will find out, you can. And I encounter people all the time who don't want to know. They just want to believe, and that's fine. And if they understand they've made a intellectual decision to be maybe dishonest, I don't want to be, you know, sound unkind, then that's okay. People who say, hey, I just want to know, I want to know the facts on it, it's out there now, and that's a wonderful thing.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, what would you say? What would be your best advice?
Know what you are. I encounter people who are very dissatisfied in what they do and where they ended up with because they thought that they needed to plug themselves into society in a certain way. And you know, society is not an overmind. There's nobody pulling the strings or anything like that. We're all people just trying to figure things out. Look at what makes you happy. And I was my unhappiest when I wasn't doing things creative. I'm my happiest when I was living up to my creative potential. And that's not a value everybody else shares. But understanding what your core thing that you want to be doing is. And so, you know, you find people who are really passionate about what they do because they clicked into something. And sometimes it's like people might say like, oh, well, I like TV. I want to get into TV. But maybe they hate TV. But the reason they hate TV is because they're not doing the thing they want to do. Maybe they want, oh, I wanted to. And then they might be like, oh, well, I wanted to create TV shows. Well, at least a few people get to do that. But I know people who build props for TV who love it because they get this opportunity like, oh, you know, we need an alien. They get to design an alien. Oh, we need to design some costumes for a 1950s style thing. We've only got these resources to do that. And they get these little, you know, these little boosts of creativity to go solve these. They're solving creative problems all the time, which makes them feel good. So I think know what motivates you is very important. And so that would be my commencement speech. Just know what motivates you. All right. Thank you, everybody. Enjoy your party.
I believe ideas can be life-changing. Mm. Is there an idea that has changed your life?
Yeah, several things. I'm very, very fortunate to have friends who are much, much smarter than I am, who make some very interesting observations and pull out things that we knew about a long time ago and then realize that. And theory of mind, I mentioned that before, is certainly one of the most important concepts. It has really helped me understand people around me. It's made me a much more compassionate and patient person. Although if you met me, you would not think I was compassionate or patient. But I'm not one of these people that blames other people for my own problems. And just the understanding that somebody else's head, there's their own mind with their own assumptions, and they don't have the same set of information you have. And that is a very, you know, the theory of mind, when I read about that, I said, man, this just understanding this concept, I understand why some people have a difficult time dealing with other people, why they're always calling people stupid and saying that the world is stupid or things are stupid, yet they're doing stupid things. It's because of this fundamental lack of understanding how other people see things. Mm-hmm. So that was a very, very, you know, important thing. And another silly thing, I mean, not silly, but important thing, was this: there's an economic concept called comparative advantage, which that understanding comparative advantage, which a guy named Ricardo in like 1712 or something, somewhere around there, kind of just described this. And that helped me understand economics and everything else around that and why things work, which is, it's worth looking into. Ricardo's rule or comparative advantage.
The last question has helped me become better at this process. Think of a defining moment in your life that we haven't talked about. What should I have asked you to have you tell me that story?
And it kind of touches back to a thing, is I think that a problem that I know that I've had and a lot of people have is not understanding core values. And we have the problem when we talk about value or virtue in modern language is that virtue is a very confused term. You know, we use sort of the Greek definition of it, which encompasses a number of attributes, many of which not under your control. You know, you can't, you know, there's up until now, really, you can't control how tall you are. You can't control how attractive you are. Maybe you control how heavy you are, whatever. But to assign things like beauty as a virtue in the same way we would honesty is a mistake. And that comes from sort of the, you know, kind of the you know, the ancient civilization sort of had this idea that people were inherently these things in many ways, where I disagree. You know, you can become virtuous in many ways and have values like honesty and integrity and stuff like that. And too many people decide that, you know, they're going to base that upon what everybody else is around them. And, you know, for me, you know, the most important thing for me, the most, you know, life-changing experience is just, you know, I have a wonderful father and a wonderful mother, and realizing my father is the most honest person I've ever met. I've never seen my father lie. My father has never lied, not even a small lie, not even, you know, somebody's on the phone he doesn't want to talk to, tell them I'm not here. And my father is a very, very successful person. My father, law enforcement, did undercover work. And I guess he lied there. But that was just the realization of it, that, you know, here's my dad, who's a very, very moral, compassionate person, very involved in his community, very involved in that. And he's not a person that's ever said, well, I'll do what everybody else did, or I'm going to change my moral compass because it worked for other people. He never compromised that. And never had a very, very happy, very fulfilled guy. My dad loves to fish. You know, he still is to this day, he works. He's involved now in, he has a company that like sells, you know, fly fishing rods, things like that through eBay. My dad will get up at 6 a.m., go out on his boat, go fish for a couple hours, come home, take a nap, go take care of stuff. And he lives an awesome life. And that's in, because my dad just, he knows who he is. And that is just watching my father has been the most informative thing for me. So maybe it's a question is like, what person, you know, guided me the most?
Does your dad's virtue stem from a philosophical or religious background?
I think, you know, his family, you know, he's got this sort of the Scandinavian roots, but Scandinavian people come in all sorts of varieties. He is a person that, you know, is his own person. His father, you know, my grandfather was a great man himself, but wanted my father to follow in certain footsteps. My father wanted to do his own path. My father and my mother both were raised congregational. So part of their religious upbringing, you know, and end up with me, you know, a non-believer, but their religious upbringing involved going around to different, go to a synagogue, go to a Catholic church, and to do that. So it was a very community-focused value. And so we talk about values. My father has a very, very high value on community, and not in a socialist what everybody else should do, but what you should do. And so my father's a person that's involved in, he lives in a city, Palm City, about an hour north of me, where he lives on the water, and he's very involved in keeping the local environment clean and pursuing issues and doing things like that. doing fly rod, you know, teaching young people how to fly fish and doing stuff like that. So he's a very community focused person. I think that is when you draw a circle around yourself, you say, okay, who are you? What are you? Now you can just drive it around your body, or you can drive it around the things. As a creative person, you can say, well, I'm this, I'm my books, you're your podcast, you're this. You know, my father is that, and my father looks at his sphere of influence and says, how can I be a positive person? And so my father's like that. My grandfather was a businessman, was an RCA vice president, and was a corporate gypsy. Every 2 years would move. And whenever they would move, they would come to a town. My grandfather would become a member of the smallest church there was in a town, a church that was maybe operating out of a storefront or a basement or a school or whatever. And by 2 or 3 years later, by the time he moved away, he would get their finances in order. He would set them up so they had their own property, they had their own building, and they became a thriving church. And so that was my grandfather, was a church builder. And not an overtly religious guy. I mean, he was a very community focused. So I see that in my father. My father's brother, my uncle, same thing. They're very, very focused. So their value systems are drawn very much around what they can do around them. Not in trying to politicking and advocating for political candidates, which I think is a wasted energy for a lot of people, but what can they do today to get people around them to be motivated and do good things?
Do you find religion inconsistent with being a skeptic?
I think that the thing that matters most to me is how you are to your neighbor. And I know, you know, I would describe myself as an atheist, and I know other atheists who I feel like ideologically are very, very different from me and probably would not make very good neighbors. And, you know, because their value system is different. You know, this core idea you have about what was it? Was a magical process what started this with a personality behind it, or was it a random thing we can't understand that started it? You know, something that happened 17 billion years ago. What matters to me most is how are you as a person? And religion, I think, becomes a problem when people expect intervention. There's one thing to say I want intervention because I want to have hope or I want to feel better about. That's mm-hmm. fine. I understand that. That's a thing that everybody, you know, is going to want at some point or another. But when you want intervention in physical reality and you depend upon that, that's where I see things becoming problematic, because we live in a physical world. We live in a world where, as far as we understand, there are many, many mysteries, but when we, you know, what helps us, what makes things better, it's people doing things and taking actions. And the more we hope those actions are caused by a magical interventionalist, that's problematic for me. You know, again, I have no issue with somebody saying, I believe in this for hope or believe in this, because that is a, you know, what does that mean? I can't even describe that. So I get my concern with that is just people who, and that's why, you know, religion comes in so many different varieties. When you hear people say, oh, we all worship the same God, that is not true. We all know that's not true. You know, there's some people's notion of God tells them to do very, very horrible things. There are parts of this world where, you know, women aren't allowed to show their faces and not drive, and children are treated in horrific ways because that God says it's okay. And there are people in our own country who have their God tells them to do crazy, weird stuff. I prefer to say, let me take the God thing out of the question entirely and ask, how can I be a good person to the person? How would they feel that I was a good person? And it doesn't happen by me, you know, putting something around my neck or telling people like, oh, I subscribe to this. It happens through my actions.
I want to thank Andrew Main for joining me today. Thanks, Andrew. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.